WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
When something just doesn't work right, we blame it on the design, or more often we blame ourselves for failing to understand how something functions. Donald Norman believes that we're too hard on ourselves. He thinks too many things designed by engineers work well in the lab, but don't function well in actual use. Norman is an industrial psychologist and author of The Psychology of Everyday Things. He teaches in the Department of Cognitive Sciences at University of California, San Diego. I ask him to define good design.
Well, first we better talk about what we mean by good. For example, things that win prizes are not what I'm talking about, because normally they win a prize because they look good, they're aesthetically pleasing. That's not what I mean. What I mean is something that works. You can figure out how the damn thing does its job and you understand it. That's what I mean by good design.
What works for you? What do you consider the ideal melding of form and function?
A pencil.
Because?
Fits the hand, leaves the mark on the paper, is comfortable, portable, easy to carry. Simple things for simple functions. I mean, I really think in general that's the rule, that something can be designed very well to do a task. The difficulty comes when you try to make something do 20 tasks. The VCR is an example because the problem is that it's trying to do so much with so, you know, few controls. Or the famous digital watch, which tried to measure lots and lots of things instead of just telling you the time. When you have a simple thing like an egg beater, it works well because that's all it does. It can be designed for that function. It's when you mix things that you have trouble. You buy them for reasons that have almost nothing to do with whether they actually function well in the home. Then when they come into the home and they don't function well, well, people tend not to complain. So as a result, the manufacturers never hear these complaints. In fact, when I complain to them, they say, I must be somebody weird because they've never heard any complaints before.
Now, sometimes when you complain, you do so professionally as a consultant. What are you consulting on now?
Well, I do some work in the computer industry, a little bit in the consumer electronics industry. What I like to do is talk to the company in the very beginning about the whole philosophy they should be following and about the way they should set up testing organizations and the way their engineers and designers ought to work with each other and the general philosophy. So I work at a much higher level because what I want to do is change the whole approach the company is taking, not just, say, modify one single product, which, you know, only has a short life.
So what are some of the larger organizational issues then? Presumably an organization is set up to function toward one goal, which is to, say, manufacture a product and to sell it and to make a profit. And people would join in that effort.
No. Gee, what a naive view of organizations. Uh-uh. I mean, that's what you put in the annual report, right? No. In an organization, you know, each person, the manager of a group of people, that person's job is to get promoted or to get a reward or to, you know, to feel good. And so, in fact, if there are difficulty, that person doesn't want to say so. And so you've got a whole bunch of managers each competing with each other to be noticed by the higher management. So they will be selected for the next promotion or the bigger office.
I had an experience purchasing a cassette player for my car. Walked into the store, found one I liked, and liked where the cassette was, and I could see the tuner and tune it very easily. And it wasn't until it was installed in the car did I realize that when the cassette was not in use, it was slightly popped out of the cassette player, it blocked my view of the radio dial. And I didn't notice this in the store because the devices are displayed at eye level when you're standing up. But in the dash, it was an entire different story. And I'm thinking, presumably, somebody at the car radio tape player manufacturing place would have tried this out and noticed it.
Heavens no. Try it out? In a real car? Come on now.
Sure, why not?
Because that would be logical and sensible. Look, I was visited the other day by four Japanese engineers from a major Japanese automobile manufacturing company. And they were so proud of themselves, and they brought to me the design of the interior of the car. And they had shown, they had all the competing manufacturers' cars and their own cars, and they were trying to compare the differences, and they wanted my opinions. And they showed me a whole bunch of switches. They were trying to decide which switch they should put in the dashboard, and they put them out on the table in front of me, and they asked for my opinion. And, you know, I looked at the switches and I said, this one is obviously of high quality and this one is pretty cheap and junky. And so I bet you want the high quality one. And they nodded their heads and smiled. And I said, no, 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 this isn't how you find out. You build a mock-up of an automobile and you get a family in there. You have a father driving, say, this is a Japanese family, so we'll have the father driving, we'll have the mother beside, we'll have three yelling, screaming kids in the back seat. Then you decide which switch works best. Try it there. Or maybe think about in the snow and you're wearing gloves and you're trying to find the switch and push them. And, you know, maybe the cheap switch will be better because it makes a big clunk when it makes contact. Maybe that's good when it's noisy. But they said they couldn't do this because it would be too expensive to build a mock-up. Now, that's crazy. And I opened up the brochures they had showed me, and there was this huge, expensive mock-up of the whole automobile in order to test the shock absorbers. See, they're willing to do that for the mechanical parts because, after all, it requires it for reliability. No one is willing to spend a fraction of that money to test the human parts because that seems so obvious.
Much has been made about the way we're now using computers, powerful machines that sometimes help us do our work. And the way we work with them, the interface, is often a cause for discussion, admiration. Some people like the way the Macintosh looks. Some people like the way IBM's look. How important is this interface on the screen to us? Are we once again adapting to computer manufacturers' sense of how things should work?
Well, the computer business is interesting because it's maybe the first one that forced upon the public or upon the manufacturers the realization that they had really better worry about the user. That, see, in the early days, computers were used by highly technical, skilled people, and nobody cared if the ordinary user couldn't use it. They weren't supposed to. But now that the personal computer has become so popular, it has become very important that things be usable. Now, I think the real problem is that they're computers. See, computers are invisible. They do all their stuff inside. In the old days, we had these mechanical things, and if you got confused, you could always look at it and figure it out. So what I would like to do is get rid of the computer, or at least hide it so you can't see it. So I still want my pencil to look like a pencil, and I don't care if it has a secret computer inside of it. I'd like a typewriter maybe to look like a typewriter. And my favorite example was the electric motor. You don't go into your kitchen to use your electric motor, and you don't talk about electric motor interfaces. You may use a blender. You may use a garbage disposal. You may use a coffee grinder. Now, those are almost pure electric motors, but you don't think of it that way. You think of it as a device for doing your task. If we redesign computers that way, they might be usable. We wouldn't even think of them as computers. We just do our task.
You're currently accompanying airline pilots on their flights to study their behavior. What do you hope to learn?
Well, at the University of California, I'm doing research with a contract from NASA, the NA part of NASA, National Aeronautics, looking at aviation safety. And we're looking at the procedures that pilots use in the cockpit. As far as I can tell, almost nobody has really thought about the pilots. Nobody's on the side of the pilots. Everybody crams more and more equipment into that cockpit. So much so that the windows are really tiny. You can barely see out of them. The new electronic, so-called glass cockpits, really aid the pilots in many ways, but also add to their workload in others. And so we've been trying to understand the way these various pieces of equipment go together and say, you know, maybe if you step back and said, what are the tasks that are required of a pilot? Maybe there's some other redesigns that you could do that could help them. See, if you look in a cockpit, you actually see the pilots have tried to tailor it. They carry tape with them. They tape up little notices, or they unscrew the screws and put them back in with a paper clip inside so they can clip up notes to themselves on the side of the cockpit. Some airplanes, you have got to carry a flashlight around so you can shine it on the upper panel so you can read the legends.
That's reassuring.
Yeah, I mean, some of the standard equipment issued to pilots and crew is a flashlight and a roll of tape. Well, that just sounds weird. I mean, it means that people haven't really thought this through in the design stages. There's no place to put your legs or no place to put your coffee cups. You've got to use big, bulky manuals, procedure manuals sometimes, yet there's no convenient place to spread them out without maybe hitting the instruments or spilling your coffee over everything. You spill a cup of coffee into the radio navigation instruments, it's not a good thing.
Over the past couple of days, say over the weekend, did you go into a store, a hardware store, a pharmacy, find something that you found you liked but then was incredibly poorly designed?
Yeah. just this weekend, my wife and I went to a hardware store and decided that, you know, we timed to light up our backyard. So we bought a kit of 10 different lights that we could install in the backyard. And it looked like it should be easy to do, very straightforward. And in principle, it was, but we spent the whole weekend and we still haven't finished. Not a single light that I connected worked.
What did you see in, say, the hardware store that you think works well as ideal melding of form and function?
Actually, many of the tools in hardware stores are really excellent. They're designed by what we like to call folk design, and over the years they sort of evolved. So look at hammers, look at saws, look at screwdrivers. They're really quite well fitted to the task, quite well fitted to the hand. And what happens is that the very first hammer is built and doesn't quite work right, and so somebody modifies it slightly. And over the years and generations, they get to be a pretty perfect hammer. So that was a dramatic contrast between the superiority of folk design, with lots of time to evolve and get out all the problems, and this rapid technological pressure that says, do it better, do it faster, do it cheaper.
Donald Norman, thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Donald Norman teaches at the University of California, San Diego, and is the author of The Psychology of Everyday Things, which in paperback is called The Design of Everyday Things. Go figure the thinking behind that.